Hello, everyone. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. I am your host, Ken Mulman. Tonight, we're going to have a best-of show. Folks, I need a break. It's been a holiday weekend. There's not been a lot of news other than the crazy people getting into fights using stun guns and firing shots, Black Friday specials. Not a lot politically going on. So we're going to take a best-of show. It'll be pieces of shows that a lot of people didn't listen to for whatever reason at the time. And so hopefully you'll find them interesting and new to you. So until then, folks, I hope everybody had a good Thanksgiving, and I will see you all next week. Tune in. We've got a full hour here, so enjoy the show, and we'll be back live next week here on Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters radio network. So to get things started, as usual, we'll start with the political rhetoric generator tonight. Political rhetoric, randomly generated political rhetoric, easy for me to say, is as follows. Unlike myself, my opponent wants an America where biased media insiders and Somali pirates can take away our innocent babies' smiles. So, a few little miscellaneous things tonight. A company in Japan has developed glasses that stymie the facial recognition stuff that's becoming more and more prevalent. And I don't know if you guys have seen this. Those of you who use Facebook, it's kind of scary that Facebook is now prompting me when I see a picture of someone with my friend in it to tag my friend. And it knows exactly who they are, and it knows exactly where they are. It's like, hey, would you like to tag them? It's like, well, wait a second. Why are you asking me to do it? You already know they're there. I mean, is that just to make you feel a little less big brotherish that, you know, you're prompting other people to tag people in photos? Or what's the deal? I mean, that's kind of weird that you know who they are. And boy, is that uncomfortable. I mean, I think that's really kind of over the line. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but I'm not real comfortable with Facebook and Google and all these things doing the facial recognition stuff on photos. And I think that that's not good for privacy. And I don't know. I mean, it just doesn't, just kind of weirds me out. I don't know you all, but I'm not a big fan of it at all. Anyway, a company in Japan has come up with some glasses that screw with the facial recognition software that's out there. And essentially what it does, and this is kind of silly, it puts out light from a almost infrared or at an almost infrared band of light and makes it so that the normal person wouldn't see this light on, but the facial recognition software would pick it up because it's picture, and it'll mess it up because it's got this extra light and it's just distorting the picture that it's looking at. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing, and I'm going to have to look into this a little more. I think that that should be that could be a very interesting project to take on and see about, you know, for those who wear glasses and a possibility of, you know, somehow sneaking those in there so they don't look so goofy, because this design, I mean, it looks really funny. If you've ever seen in basketball, when the basketball players have those big safety goggles on, I don't know how else to explain them, but they're big safety goggle-looking things. That's essentially what this looks like right now. It's a big safety goggles-looking thing with a bunch of lights in it. So I think that some improvements going to be needed to the design to make it so it's not so weird-looking. But I think it is anything we can do to try to protect our privacy, I think, is a good thing. I don't feel comfortable with all these facial recognition softwares and all this. I just think that it's a big, have a very big problem with all of it. Anyway, moving on. Last week we talked about the parties. We talked about third parties. We talked about a number of things, and I didn't get to quite all the material. We ran out of time, and I wanted to get to some of that, and because some of it's a little bit more general. You know, we talked about the Virginia governor's race. There's been even more numbers that have come out that pretty much definitively show that, you know, the Republicans lost that race all on their own. And in fact, the Republican campaign isn't blaming the Libertarian for his loss. What he's blaming for his loss is that the national GOP basically abandoned him. And, you know, I think that to an extent that's true. If you look at the fundraising and you look at how the money came in, you know, and this isn't off your election, or was, rather, you know, the Republican candidate just didn't bring in as much money as the Democrat candidate. And I don't know if I've ever shared this rule with you all in my audience, but, you know, I've done a lot of analysis of a lot of political races. I mean, I've looked at a lot of races. Not just because of my duties within the Libertarian Party, but just in general. I legitimately find it interesting that if I went back to school, I would like to go into political science. I really honestly find a lot of this stuff just genuinely interesting. And because politics, as I like to say, is policy and, now I forgot my own quote. That's terrible. but essentially, it's a popularity contest with policy thrown in to boot. And it's interesting because with a strong enough message, you can get outspent by about 4-1 and still have a chance of winning. If your message is superior and you're able to get it out there and articulate it, right, that's part of having a good message is being able to articulate that message. If you can get that message out there with about four, even being outspent 4-1, and if your opponent has a bad message or no message at all other than this guy sucks, you should vote for me, which is a pretty common message in elections these days. If you have a strong enough message, you can get outspent by up to 4-1 and still have a chance of winning. Once you get outspent by more than 4-1, you're pretty much toast. And the reason is because at that point you're being flooded in the media and just overwhelmed. And the media is just full of you, of your opponent getting drowned and lost in that. And that also ties into third-party, independent, libertarian, whatever candidacies. When you're running in a three-way race or a four-way race and the media has already kind of set the tone that two others are it, and the money just isn't there, which is funny because in part the reason the money isn't there is because the media has already set the tone. It's giant chicken and egg problems with the whole electoral system, and I'll go into that in a little bit here, but once you've set the tone, once the media has set the tone, it's very difficult to change the media and change its tone. They start saying it's this versus this, it's this versus this. The media set the tone in that Virginia governor's race that the Libertarian was going to cost the Republican the election. And in many ways, that's why there are still tons of people out there who really do believe that the Libertarian candidate made the GOP candidate lose. The reality is the Republican candidate did not have that strong of a message. Like I said, I watched that race for 4 months. And in the polls for the entire time, that entire 4 months, the Republican candidate sat at high 30 to low 40%. The Democratic candidate was in the low 40s to high 40s the entire time. And the Democrat was just about to cross over 50% when the Obamacare mess all kind of hit, which, you know, whatever. And the Democrats would take a hit, certainly. But what we saw is that those people were otherwise Democrat voters that went to the Libertarian candidate. We talked about this. Those votes would have never have gone to the Republican candidate. Those are people who would have otherwise either stayed home or would have held their nose and voted for the Democrat. And the real sad thing about that is that there were a lot of people. I mean, there was a newspaper that actually endorsed, even in the face of the fact, they knew that Sarvis could not win the Libertarian candidate in Virginia. They endorsed him anyway. Pretty powerful. Because the reality is, Sarvis actually would have, or had anyway, a better platform than the Republican and the Democratic candidates. So then it's a question of, what's wrong? Why can't independent and third-party candidates win? And I think that what we're seeing now is a shift. And I talked to a Tea Party group this week about our electoral system and how we've gone through changes through time, how things have changed over time, and why, and what were the main things going on in different periods of history. And basically what they call these things is the party system. Starting from the signing of the Constitution forward, we've had basically five eras. And in each of the eras, there's different themes, there's different things that are going on. And it really wasn't until the beginning of what they call the third party system, the fourth party system, where ballot access rules and different things were changed. And there were some very fundamental changes to the way that we vote that occurred during that period. Previously, you saw candidates running under multiple tickets. So in other words, Bob Jones was running for office, and he may get the endorsement of three or four local parties in the area, whatever. You know, that was pretty common. That was no big deal, right? I mean, that was what they called fusion ticketing, where one candidate would receive more endorsements than just one party. And the reason is because when you used to go to the polls, there'd be people standing outside the polls with pieces of paper and say, hey, you should vote for our ticket. And you've heard the term straight ticket, of course. Well, a ticket used to be a literal piece of paper with a list of names. And what they would do, the paper would be a slightly different color or whatever, and you would go in and put it in the ballot box. And the term splitting the ticket meant that you tore someone out of your ticket, right? That's what splitting the ticket was. You fast forward to today when the exact opposite is true. Today, you have no one is allowed, right, to electioneer, as they call it, outside the polls. And that was done supposedly to end voter intimidation. You have this party ticket mechanism is just a button on the ballot now, the electronic ballot, rather than being some sort of piece of paper or whatever given to you by a party. So instead of a private party giving you a list or a suggestion list, it's now the government providing the means for that list. And you have it really a focus on party rather than individual candidates. I mean, we've moved a really long way away from where we started. And then on top of that, one of the things I love to talk about is how the very first Congress, there were approximately 33,000 people, and I have to use that in quotes because the three-fifths clause was in effect then, which is horrible and whatever, but it is what it is. There were about 33,000 people that were represented by one U.S. representative. Today, that number is 725,000 people, 725,000 people. By contrast, or as a means of comparison, in the state Senate, the State House, Kentucky State House, there are approximately 44,000 people per State House rep. So basically, today, House of Representatives is 33% less representative than the original United States Congress. Our United States Congress is more than, I'm not going to be able to do the math in my head, but about 25 times less representative than it was originally. And what that's done is it's made these races bigger. It's made them require more money. It's made them require, this is all stuff that came about over time, and it changed little by little over time. But it fundamentally changed what we had originally versus what we have now. And it's an important thing to know because people like to talk about the founding fathers. They like to talk about the things that we had and why are things, we want to go back to the way they were. But no one's talking about the real core fundamental things that changed over time. And ironically, many times the people talking about, wanting to go back to the way it was are Republicans who oppose reforms that would put us back to things were. Meanwhile, Democrats are the ones who, and not the parties, but their supporters, are often the ones talking about, claiming their progressive ideas of making things more democratic and more representative, which really is moving us back towards where we came from. And it is kind of interesting and ironic. And the reality is there are a number of reforms that could be done. That are really nonpartisan, that could really help the system. I mentioned last week we had an article, it was an op-ed published in Forbes about a Republican Party that can't win versus a Democratic Party that can govern. And I think in many, many ways, that's exactly how many people feel. Essentially, the policies, the talking points of many Republicans are not popular, and specifically the social conservatives who want to bring back draconian social restrictions. Yeah, well, they say that kind of stuff, but that could never happen. Oh, yeah? Take a look at some of the Middle Eastern countries in the 50s and 60s. And then look what happened after they were taken over by extreme religious factions. It can happen. It absolutely can. So Republicans are not popular because of their social con stuff. And I really do think that's the main thing. I don't think it's... The Republican establishment likes to talk about the makers versus the takers and all that garbage. And that might be true to a limited extent, maybe. But quite honestly, I don't think that's the real problem. I think the real problem is that when you start running on a socially conservative platform, and not that there's anything wrong with being a social conservative personally. I am a social conservative personally. I live a socially conservative lifestyle. The difference, though, is that I don't run around trying to impose that on other people. Just because something works for me doesn't mean it works for everyone. And that's the key understanding that Republicans and Democrats both miss. Just because it's right for you doesn't mean you have the right to cram it down somebody else's throat. And I think more and more people are starting to realize this. I mean, again, the Republicans can't win. The Democrats can't govern. We're still in this recession. They're talking about more quantitative easing. We keep talking more and more. That's not going to work. And once again, I started talking with somebody about inflation here. I guess it was at the Tea Party meeting about the inflation and the price of food. And honestly, I just honestly hadn't been shopping in a while. The wife takes care of that. And I was amazed to find out that prices are still going up. And, you know, the other side of it, what was kind of interesting, is that the size of the portions you're buying go down. You know, we had my youngest had a birthday party today. And we made some food for our guests, usually it's kind of a small summer gathering. And we made food, and one of the things we made was meatballs. And my wife was surprised. You know, she just went and got the frozen meatballs and warmed them up in the crock pot, but she was surprised at how much smaller meatballs have, the packages of meatballs have become. I mean, it's not even been a year since we bought meatballs the last time. I don't know. I mean, things keep getting worse. And I honestly believe that in part the Republicans don't want to win. And I've had over and over and over. But I don't think the Republicans want to win. I think the establishment Republicans don't mind if they win. But the establishment Republicans don't want the Tea Party Republicans to win. Cuccinelli in Virginia, the Republican in Virginia's race, was not winning. He was running a typical Republican race. In the primary, apparently, he ran more as a Tea Party guy. When he got into the general, his advisors told him to run a more generic race. And so he was for a while. But what that did was it shook his core support. His core support were the Tea Party folks. And so he was getting money from the establishment until fired his campaign team. His campaign team were establishment folks, my understanding anyway. And once he fired them, the national money dried up. They basically said, okay, you're a Tea Party guy, you're done. We're not going to play ball. And we've seen the stories that have come out. I'm looking at one here from the Washington Times. I think this is from last week. Yeah, a week and a half ago. About the GOP establishment declaring war on the Tea Party faction, and that the GOP is out raising money from the business community to primary the so-called Tea Party leaders in the House and Senate. Now, I knew this was coming, and I called this all along, and it's kind of funny because there were a lot of people, oh, no, they'd never do that. Really? Really? You not studied your history? But essentially now, we have the establishment striking back against the Tea Party. Meanwhile, the Democrats, I don't even know what they're doing. Quite honestly, they don't seem to be doing squat. They seem to be completely paralyzed, which gets back to that whole can't govern thing. It's amazing. It's amazing that more people aren't upset. That's what's amazing to me. We're in what, year five, almost year six of this recession now. Things still aren't better. Anybody knows it. Everybody knows it. From a individual wealth perspective, 95% or more of the country has moved backwards and continues to move backwards. Things aren't getting better. Things are not getting better. And I think that's why we're starting to see results like we saw in Virginia. I think that's why we're starting to see a rise in the number of independents, and not just a rise in independents, because that's been happening for a while, but a rise in the number of vocal, angry, and rightfully so angry, independents, whatever. You have to look past the media to find your choices. And I always encourage people to vote for the best candidate. Do not be scared into being corralled into this lesser of two evils game where the thing that happened with the Republican primary last year, which was, well, Mitt Romney's the only guy who can beat Obama. Well, I guess nobody could beat him because Romney lost. The reality is, I think there were other candidates that could have beaten Obama. It's that Romney was not the guy. But that was sure the mantra that was going around, and, you know, that's what they convinced a lot of people to support Romney in the primary, was, oh, well, he can beat Obama. Well, no, that was a lie. And now hindsight proves that to be a lie. And so that's what I'm getting at is don't be corralled by the media. Don't be corralled by the talking heads for the Republican and Democratic parties. Do your thing. Do your own homework. Know who you're voting for and vote for the person that you like the best. And that's that. There's really nothing more to it. But, yeah, it'll be interesting to follow this race as it goes forward. And, you know, maybe I'll try to get a hold of some of the other candidates. Maybe we'll do that. I'll see if maybe we can get some of the candidates who have declared that are being ignored by the rest of media to come on and do an interview. I'll have to see if I can reach out and if they'd be willing to do that, given my political affiliation. It'll be interesting. I think that could be something very beneficial to our listeners. One of the things I've been trying to get to for the past few weeks is talking about how our economy hasn't gotten better. And it hasn't. Our economy is not better. They've claimed that the recession is over, and they've been claiming that since 2009. But the reality is that the recession isn't over, that we're basically no better than we were in 2009. Now, some people will point to the stock market and say, well, look, you know, the stock market recovered. Well, the problem is that the stock market, in part, is based on the value of a dollar. And in case you haven't felt it, I know I have, your dollar isn't going as far as it did 4 or 5 years ago. Groceries are more expensive. Gas is definitely hanging out at about that $3.75 a gallon mark, and it's been hanging there for a few years. It's not getting better. And anybody who is honest about it and hasn't been biased in some way, you ask the average person on the street, and they'll tell you things aren't better. The American people, this is another poll from Pew Research, 5 years after market crash, the U.S. economy is seen as no more secure. So when they ask people, are you more secure, no more secure, or don't know about your financial situation now 5 years out from the crash, 63% of Americans say they're no more secure than they were 5 years ago. Another way to say that is 63% of people say they're not better off than they were 5 years ago. Now, that's a big deal. It's a very big deal. And I've talked to various politicos about this, that in a prolonged recession, when the people in office are not seen as part of the solution, anything can happen. In a political race, anything can happen. You know, the idea that Mark Bevin could have a legitimate chance challenging Mitch McConnell would have been laughable 6 years ago. But we've been in a recession for 5 years. Mitch McConnell has taken a good bit of criticism over that time. Most of it, if not all of it, rightfully so. He was the one that voted and cheerleaded for the TARP bailouts, which were horrible. And everybody you ask says, hey, should we have bailed out the banks? No. You have a small percentage that, oh, yeah, well, you know, we needed to do it in order to stop a bank crash. Yeah, whatever. You don't know. You can't prove a negative anyway. And even if those big banks had crashed, the little guys would have survived and the little guys would have benefited. So the point is, we're not better off. Another story that ran in USA Today about the 5% recovery. Those in the top 5% income bracket, the recovery's been okay. It's been pretty good. But the other 95% of Americans, not really. They haven't seen a turnaround. Their wealth, their overall net worth, their net wealth decreasing or staying stagnant is not recovering. It's things are not better. People know they're not better. Anybody who isn't tied to some political philosophy or tied to some position knows that things aren't better. So I'm looking here at a chart of U6. U6 is overall unemployment. U5 is not overall. There's a few things exempted. But here's the point. Officially, unemployment in the United States is at 7.3% as of August. But U6, which is the real unemployment number, is at 13.7%. Now, make no mistake, right before the crash, before everything got horrible, U6, true unemployment, was at 8%. And now the government's bogus numbers are at 7.3, where they exclude half the people who are unemployed. It's 7.3. The real number shift here, the real unemployment, is 13.7%, up from 8%, and it has not recovered. Yeah, there's been some. I mean, the highest was 17.4% at U6. So, I mean, it's not as bad as it was at the peak, certainly. And that was October 2009 was the peak. But people are not happy, and rightfully so. People are still feeling a pinch, not surprisingly so. Inflation has been out of control. Absolutely out of control. Got a chart here that shows the consumer price index from January 1939 going forward. And if you look at, let's go from January 2009 here, if I can. It's kind of hard to use this. There you go. Well, whatever. All right. February 2009, the consumer price index as weighted against January 1939, well, it's almost laughable, 1,415%. So, you know, your money went 1/14 as far as it did, or would that be 14 times less? I don't even know how to read that. 14, it looks like it's 1/14 of what it used to be. And now, let's see here. 1568%. So we're up over 100% of where it used to go. So the point of this chart, even though it's hard to read and hard to understand, is that the consumer price index continues to climb. Goods and services continue to cost more. And we know that. Everybody knows that. Anybody who's been to the grocery store lately knows. Anybody who's been to a restaurant lately, have you been to a restaurant lately? Notice the prices are going up? Yeah, they are. Because the raw cost of those goods is going up. Another chart I have here is total public debt as a percentage of gross domestic product. And starting in 2008-2009, the percent of debt, the GDP to debt ratio was about 60%. I may have said that backwards. Debt to GDP was 60%, a little over. Looks like about 63, 64%. It is now over 100%. What does that mean? That means we have buried ourselves in debt. That's what it means. And we've buried ourselves in debt because we can't afford the things we used to afford. Right? And to stay afloat, we're borrowing. It's not a long-term solution. And combined with the fact that we keep printing more dollars and we keep digging ourselves further into debt, the cost of goods is going to continue to go up. This has led to calls for, again, a raise in the minimum wage. But the problem is the minimum wage doesn't solve these problems. The minimum wage is a Band-Aid. And there's a big, long philosophical conversation about minimum wage I'm not going to get into tonight. But it's not solving the problem. The problem is that we're spending like it's going out of style, and we're printing money like we're some sort of drunken counterfeiters. And, of course, there's going to be economic ramifications to that. There of course, are going to be. There has to be. Things aren't getting better. And the only way they're going to get better is if people take an opportunity or if people who are in the liberty movement take the opportunity to explain to people why it is their dollar doesn't go as far as it used to. Why does everything cost more? Why aren't our leaders doing more about this? And we need to be talking to others, and we need to be figuring out what it is that we can do to fix this problem. Now, I have my ideas, of course. You could vote out 95% of the folks in Congress. That would be a good start. But it's not just there. It's not just there. Runaway government, and this is the funniest part, with the continued recession, governments have really started feeling the pinch, and so they're doing crazy things to try to make their budgets fall in line and with their plans. And the problem with that is government entities derive their revenue solely from taxpayers. Now, this leads into our last topic for tonight, the libraries in Kentucky. Library boards are not elected. A list of names is submitted to the Kentucky Department of Libraries and Archives down in Frankfort. KDLA then narrows that list down to three people. Those three people then are sent back to the county, and the local judge executive gets to appoint one of those three people. That's the process that of filling a vacancy on the library board. They, in the library board, want the ability to raise your taxes. These people are not elected. I will reemphasize that. They want to be able to tax without being elected. Or shall we say another way, which is more popularly or well known, they want taxation without representation. The libraries, and make no mistake, there are other entities in the state that are, all of our taxing districts are appointed in weird, goofy, stupid ways. Most of them are not directly elected. Some of them are partially elected, like fire boards, which that's a really weird one. Fire boards are elected some weekend in June. The polls are open at your firehouse for like 3 hours, and only property owners, which, by the way, is completely illegal, but only property owners can run for or vote in the elections for fire board. But health departments are appointed as well. There's lots of different boards and lots of different ways that they're put in. But in 1978, the state of Kentucky passed House Bill 44. 78 or 79. Now I'm blanking on whether it was 78 or 79, so I'm going to say the late 70s. And it created what is now known as the compensating rate rule. The idea behind this was to ensure that a taxing entity would bring in the same or a little bit more money than they brought in the year before. Regardless of what property values did, they would adjust the tax rate to make it so that the amount of revenue, tax revenue, the entity brought in was the same. So this is a government-centric formula. That's the hard part for people to get over, right? This is government-centric. It's about how many dollars does the government bring into its little entity, right, the little fiefdom there. And so that's the first hurdle you got to get over. Don't think about your taxes. Think about money to the entity. That means that if your property values across the county doubled, then in theory the tax rate would be halved, and the same amount of money would come in the year following, or just a little bit more. And there's a little bit of math errors and math fudging and all this, and it always, of course, fudges in favor of the taxing entity. But you're talking about hundredths of a percent, so it's not that big of a deal, right? You're talking maybe $50,000 in $1 million budget or $2 million budget. It's not a huge deal there. But the compensating rate rule is very complex, and it's not worded very well, and unfortunately it's being abused. So there's a problem with compensating rate as it is. And that's issue number one, is that in one case, for instance, there's a board downstate, a special taxing district, that is claiming they're taking compensating rate, which in theory should mean maybe they get an extra 10 grand or whatever because of the rounding errors, but stay the same. But no, they're somehow they're abusing the rule to make it so they're getting a 7% increase. 7% increase in revenue. Well, where does that revenue come from? That revenue comes from the public. And in theory, it's going to be spread out across everybody. So in theory, there's going to be, and in fact, it is just about, a 7% increase in the tax rate. So they are raising your taxes, but claiming they're not. And I have a big problem with that because that's a lie. It's a big, fat lie. So that's part of the problem. Now, with the libraries in particular, there's a lawsuit going on around the state. If you haven't been up on this issue, up here in Northern Kentucky is where they started. And essentially, there are a total of 80 library districts that were formed by petition prior to 1984. And this lawsuit that was filed up here basically calls into question Kentucky Revised Statute number 173.790. And essentially what that does is says that if a library board formed before 1984 wants to raise their taxes, they must use petitioning if they were formed by petition. If they were formed by citizen ballot, then they must raise their taxes at the ballot. Somewhere along the way, between 1978 and today, the libraries started using the other way, the compensating rate way of raising taxes, rather than petition. And the problem there, it's kind of hard to explain the big long story on how they got here. We had a forum up here in Northern Kentucky on Wednesday night about all this, and there was a 7-minute part of it that explained how we got here. But essentially, there were activists and citizens of the county that went to the library board because the library board wanted to create a fourth branch that in the end, based on the numbers and everything else, was not necessary. And you could argue about whether or not it was necessary, but the issue was actually put onto the ballot, even though that wasn't legal. It was put onto the ballot, and it lost 62-38. So the public has decided that they don't want this branch. But the library had already made certain commitments before even putting it on the ballot. For instance, they purchased land, about 4.5 acres of land, for $1 million. When all of the surrounding land went for about $25,000 an acre, they spent $220,000 an acre. Insane. Absolutely insane. Even if they sold that property, they wouldn't be able to get that money back out of it. This led people to complain and say, we don't like what you're doing, and essentially the library board told people to go pound sand, that they could do what they wanted, and they were going to do what they wanted. And so these activists and these folks, and some were in the Tea Party, and that's the way you'll hear it reported, Tea Party versus the library. It's beyond the Tea Party, unless 62% of Campbell County's Tea Party, in which case all the elected officials in the establishment better watch out. But the point is, the citizens in the county got involved, said we don't want this library. They were going to incur a huge amount of debt. And in that, there was a law that prevented taxing entities from doing that, but there's a loophole, and that's what the library was going to use, is the loophole. So the activists then went to the library board and said, you can't do this because of this law, this 173-790. And they said, no, that doesn't apply to us. And they said, no, we're pretty sure that it does. And they just said, nope, doesn't apply, even though it spells out exactly that it does. And they also then went to the county fiscal court, because the county fiscal court does have somewhat a questionable ability to veto a tax increase from other taxing entities in the county, although that's questionable as to whether or not that would work. And the fiscal court said, no, we're not getting involved. And so a lawsuit ensued. And now, you know, the media is out there saying, oh, it's the Tea Party versus the libraries. The Tea Parties are against the libraries. And nothing is further from the truth. And thankfully, at the forum, it came out that that's exactly the case. The Tea Parties are not against the libraries. And in fact, the community is not against the libraries. However, what people are against are taxing entities that are not responsible to the public. There is no accountability. Who tells the taxing district no? Who has the authority to do that? If they're able to be appointed from Frankfurt and raise your taxes without question and have no means to stop or to stop them, doesn't that mean they're unaccountable? Of course it does. And so that's what people are really upset about, is accountability. There's a lot of other side issues in this. The libraries around the country are suffering cutbacks because in most places, libraries are controlled by the city or are controlled by a county. And in fact, here in Kentucky, I believe that the Louisville Library and I think the Lexington Library are controlled by those cities, respectively, because they are city libraries, not a county library taxing district. And so libraries around the country are suffering massive cutbacks because as cities feel the crunch of this recession, and believe me, they just started feeling this crunch in 2011. As they've started to feel the crunch, they've pulled money out of the libraries to do crazy things like pave the streets. What? Yeah, so the point is that the libraries are pushed down on the priority list on top of the fact that technology is changing. And you talk to anybody who's under 18 today, any teenager, and say, do you want to go to the library or do you want to just download the book on your Kindle or whatever, your e-reader, your tablet, whatever, they're going to say, let's get on my tablet. That's the problem the library faces. And so they're trying to protect their turf and they're trying to protect their reason for existence. But they're doing so in a way that is not taking public input. And that's a huge problem. There should be no taxation without representation, ever. And there are common sense ways to fix this, but it's going to require Frankfurt to act. Frankfurt needs to modify the laws, and honestly, I wish they would standardize it across the board with all the issues-based petitioning. Some only take 1,000 signatures. Some take 51% of the number of people that voted in the last election. Huge disparity. How about we just put it at 10% of the people who voted in the last election? Interestingly, the band Nannies are at it again. Just saw a story here about Michael Bloomberg in New York City, the guy in charge of all the food bans and enforcing that stuff. City of New York has now outlawed donations of food to homeless shelters because the city can't assess their fat, salt, and fiber content. Because, you know, obviously homeless people are the people that need to be worried about fiber and fat and salt. I mean, they're homeless. They have no job, obviously, or if they do have a job, it's not enough to sustain a household. In New York, that's not necessarily surprising. It costs a fortune there. But they're homeless. They have bigger problems than worrying about whether or not their meal has too much salt. Dun, dun, dun. Oh, no, not too much salt. And, you know, it's funny because we saw some of this, a year and a half ago when the tornadoes tore through northern Kentucky. And the Northern Kentucky Health Department, or Independent Health District, as they're known, actually banned people from bringing prepared food to those who had just lost their homes to a tornado. I mean, really? Yeah, you know, that's their big concern. They've just lost their home. They've lost all of their possessions. They're probably not really worried about food preparation stuff. That's really not their main concern. And understand, for those of you that live in the city, what people in the country do when something good or something bad happens is you cook them a meal and you take it to them. I mean, that's what you do. You have a baby, people cook you a meal. You lose your house, people bring you a meal. I mean, that's the way it works in the country. And the health department literally stopped a church from receiving or distributing, rather, food that was not prepared on premise for the reason that the health department couldn't determine whether or not the food had been prepared or transported in a proper manner. Because obviously that's the main concern of those folks, is whether or not that food has been prepared or transferred in the proper manner. They just lost their freaking homes. Ridiculous. These health and food nannies are ridiculous people. And they prioritize things. Their priorities are just way off track. I mean, these are the same people that push for smoking bans. I mean, when we fought this up here in northern Kentucky, we were successful in two counties. The last county, they got a restaurant ban. And based on our math, they got like 12 restaurants and a bowling alley to have to go non-smoking. Other than that, everything else was kind of status quo. And they apparently dropped about $300,000 in up here. Of course, that didn't matter. It wasn't their money anyway. It came in through federal grant money through the Obama stimulus. These nannies can't control themselves. They always have to be muddling in someone else's affairs to protect them from themselves. It's what they're all about, protect people from themselves from making terrible mistakes. Oh, my gosh, that homeless person is eating way too much salt. We must protect the homeless from eating too much salt. That's the big concern, really? Oh, I don't know. These food people, the nannies, I don't get them. I really just don't get them. Completely shifting gears, one of the funny stories that I saw this week was that the FAA is warning the public against shooting at drones. And this is something that I had joked about probably last year or maybe a little longer ago, about how long would it be until people started hunting the drones and started shooting them down. And Judge Napolitano had said something similar, and apparently other organizations had picked up on it as well. Now, I wasn't really serious about actually going out drone hunting, per se, but I think that the idea that it was so popular, the idea of shooting these drones down, was so popular because people fundamentally realize they're being spied on. And that's a problem. It's funny to me, you know, we talk about rights and how far do rights go and, you know, tying back to the smoking ban and all these different things are, you know, what's allowed and what's not and where are lines drawn and, you know, I think that everyone has a right to free speech. However, I think that if you're going to have free speech with a megaphone, right, artificial amplification, then it makes sense to have a permit, right? Because now you have the ability to affect people a lot more broadly than with just your voice. I mean, if you're cranking the volume and you know, much, much louder than normal, now it kind of makes sense, right? You have a right to free speech. You can say whatever you want, but if you're going to amplify that and broadcast it to the public at large, and the public can't escape it simply by just walking away, well, okay, now it makes sense that maybe there's a permit process in place. But so long as it's not amplified, right, I think that you can say anything you want anywhere you want, anytime you want, whatever, right? Now, if you're on private property and the private property owner says, hey, man, I don't want you saying that here, you know, you say it and I'm going to ask you to leave. Well, I mean, that's a private property owner's right. But on public property, again, private versus public, public property, government-owned property, we should be allowed to say anything we want so long as it is not amplified or unnaturally loud, right? And that's kind of where I draw that line, personally. I think that there's also the idea of people being videotaped in public, right? And there's a lot of talk about cops being publicly recorded, and there's been a lot of debate, and I've been following a website called Photography is Not a Crime. And they do a lot of videotaping in public, and the police really don't like that. Despite the fact that their own cameras are recording what's going on in the public, they don't like to be recorded without their permission, which is ironic. Now, again, in the public space, you have no real expectation of privacy because you're in the public space. Now, there is a line drawn where you can't be recorded in the public space for commercial purposes. In other words, you can't be recorded for commercial purposes without your consent. And I think that that's a good line, right? Because I didn't agree for you to make money off of me, but for the purposes of openness and transparency and for the right of the public, if I'm not making money off of you, I have the right to record you when you're in public. You're in public. Hence the word public. That's kind of what it means. You're in public. Now, when you're in private, right, I don't have the right to record you if you are on private property and taking reasonable steps to not be seen in public, then if I go beyond that and record you without the permission of the property owner and without your permission, then I have violated your privacy. And there's been several court rulings back and forth on whether or not cops can spy on you in your own home. And I think the line does need to be drawn that when you're in your own home, there is a reasonable expectation of privacy so long as you're not standing in front of a window, right? If you're standing in front of a window and somebody records you through the window, video records you, then it makes sense, right? I mean, that's a line, right? Hey, if I'm at my home and I have the blinds pulled and whatever, I should be in privacy, right? And there's lots of good reasons that behind closed doors, remember, behind closed doors, that phrase, is private. Usually when we talk about behind closed doors, we're talking about government doing things that they should be doing transparently that they're not. But as individuals, we have that right to do things privately. The problem with the drones is that they're equipped with cameras that can see through things. The FLIR cameras that do a combination of infrared and night vision and all these different things. They put it together so that they can see what's there, even though it normally, by a human standard, would not be visible. And I think that that is where things get dicey, especially on private property. Now, on public property, you can make a case that we shouldn't have drones because you can't see that you're being recorded, whereas if you're in the street and you see somebody recording you, you can go into a private place and be done with that. But when you're in your own home, you should be protected with a shroud of privacy. I mean, it's your home. And I think most people pretty much get that. There is a reasonable expectation of privacy in your own home. The problem is that these drones can see through your walls. They can hear you through your walls, through amplification, through whatever. And that's a problem. Now, what brought this on, or bringing it to a head, there's a small community of Deer Trail, Colorado, that is wanting to give hunting licenses to drones. And I think it's hilarious. The permits, the hunting permit is $25. And anyone who shoots down a drone would be awarded $100 if you present your hunting license and the identifiable pieces of a drone that's been shot down. Now, the FAA saying, well, you know, it's not really safe to be just shooting stuff out of the sky because, you know, that might land on somebody. Well, yeah, it might. In fact, there's been several cases reported where drones have just fallen from the sky for whatever reason, malfunction. I'm sure that they're protected from any liability if those drones that are flying around and not shot down but are just generically broken and fall from the sky. Of course, there's no legal ramification, no liability for that. But the real crux of this, and I think this is hilarious, is there's actually a lobby group, the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, that is really pushing this issue now because they're afraid people are going to start shooting down their drones. And I think what they're really afraid of is that there's a growing backlash against this surveillance nanny state stuff, just in general. The surveillance state is getting ridiculous, and more people are realizing it. We're going to get into reasons for that after the break, but they're really the ones that are bringing this to light because I think they're afraid that as more people start shooting these things down, or if they were to, that it could bring to light how many of them there are. It could bring to light how unpopular these things are, which in the end then means fewer sales for their company. And, you know, obviously the trade group is worried about sales for their industry. So I just think it's all pretty funny. Personally, you know what, if you shoot down a drone, and I don't recommend you do that because, well, it could land on somebody, and there could be legal ramifications, but if you did, I wouldn't be crying all night over it. Let's put it that way. I mean, that's pretty straightforward. You know, drone, whatever. You know, I have a real big problem with the lack of privacy having to do with drones monitoring the public.